It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up in our weekly edition of Food Friday, we'll get ready for Mother's Day and ways to make a great meal for mom. First, Marlon Dixon was arrested when he was 14 years old for his role in the high-profile murder of a Milwaukee man. When he finished serving his prison sentence, Marlon was 32 years old. He'd spent more than half his life behind bars. Milwaukee County is taking a second look at cases like Marlon's and how young people are sentenced. Some officials say childhood trauma is an important piece of the puzzle that wasn't taken into account in the past. In a new series for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, our next guest looks at trauma, crime, and incarceration of young people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you charged with a crime at a young age? Do you work in the youth justice system yourself? And in general, how do you think youth should be sentenced in Wisconsin? What should be the bar, the line for when younger people are tried and charged as adults? What should be done to help youth who face hardships? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. James Causey is a projects reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab. He's been reporting on Milwaukee since he was in high school. James recently wrote a series called Life Correction, taking a closer look at how childhood trauma runs into the criminal justice system. James, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start where you did, James. How did you get connected with Marlon Dixon?
Well, it's really interesting. I was a O'Brien Fellow at Marquette University, and I received this call from a woman from Denver, Colorado, who said who wanted to know if the name Marlon Dixon rung a bell. And I told her it didn't. And then she asked me if I heard about the Charlie Young Jr. beating case from 2002. And of course, everyone heard about that. Mm-hmm. And she told me that Marlon was the young man who got the most time from that case. And I just couldn't believe anybody was still incarcerated from that case, because most of the people who participated were so young. And she told me that he would be getting out in a year, and she wanted to know if I could connect him to any kind of programs once he get out, once he was released, because she was worried that he would end up back in prison if he didn't have those programs in place or able to find housing and things like that. And I told her I would look out and see what I could do. She gave me his information in prison, and we started communicating. And then she told me, you know, he had a kid, and he was 14 when he was arrested, but he had a 5-month-old. And I just wanted to know what life was like for this 14-year-old being charged as an adult and spending that much time behind bars.
And that brought you to looking at adverse childhood experiences for kids. Can you talk about what Marlon's life had been like growing up?
Oh, yeah. He's the case study for trauma, actually. You know, before he participated in this this beating, his father was stabbed to death outside a methadone clinic by a man who he got into an altercation with. Prior to that, his father was very abusive to him. He beat on him, cursed at him, all kinds of things. And he grew up in a very violent neighborhood where sirens and fighting and shootings and things like that were a constant. And on top of that, you know, the educational system failed him as well. He really couldn't read well. And, you know, by the age of 14, he read at a first or second grade reading level. So he struggled throughout his life. You know, his mother did the best she could raising him and his siblings, but it was just like the streets had a stronger pull than a mother's love at that time.
Now, in talking to Marlon, he did not claim he wasn't responsible for these crimes at the young age of 14. But this started you on a track, James, of looking at how people who grew up in Marlon's situation with so many strikes against them, so many traumas, and how they're treated in the justice system. Where did you go from Marlon's case?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people, when we hear the word trauma, we think that that's something that was always there. Like, you know, trauma is talked about so much. You know, we know our military veterans and people like that have experienced trauma. We also know that, you know, police officers who go to scenes all the time like that experience trauma. But when we talk about childhood trauma, that was a relatively new concept back in 2002 when a beating took place. No one was talking about childhood trauma. And the people who were bringing it up, when it was brought up during this case, they were laughed at. It was they were told that this didn't exist. They were just, this was the age of the super predator talk. And people were talking about, you know, groups of youth going around preying on people, and these kids were just bad, and they were super predators. So that was the language of that day. So, but now, you know, after 2002, the childhood trauma started to come up more and more around 2004, 2005. And that's where people really started to talk about it more. Unfortunately for Marlon, that wasn't his case. I mean, nobody was talking about it by the time he was sentenced. But what we discovered today and what we know today about how the brain is, how a child's brain develops, what happens to you as a child has a lot of impacts on what happens to you as an adult. It impacts your emotions. It impacts how you do in school. It impacts how you have relationships. It impacts you your health, your physical health. You know, if you've been traumatized as a kid, don't we've learned that it can have impacts on your heart, your lungs, how you your overall stress levels that causes your cortisol to go up. So it's so many things that we learned about the impact of childhood trauma and how that impacts your body that it's absolutely amazing what we learned. Unfortunately, not enough is being done to address the traumas that our youth are going through on a daily basis. You know, our schools need to have more counselors on hand, and we need to really, really step up how we tackle this issue.
Talking to James Causey, projects reporter from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab, looking at his latest series on trauma and youth incarceration. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. Maybe your experiences going through, and I hope recovering from trauma as a young person. If you work in the system, the youth justice system somewhere yourself or as a counselor, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. James, you mentioned that idea of the super predator. You quote the guy, the academic who came up with this concept of the irredeemable super predator back, I think in the 80s or 90s, now saying he was wrong. And, you know, it's like these kids need more emotional help. They need hugs as much as anything. What kind of solutions do you see out there that we could use more of to keep a kid from ending up in the criminal justice system in the first place?
Well, you know, honestly, you know, things that really help youth deal with issues of trauma is really being able to see value in themselves. For instance, one part of my series our county executive, he would have been a part of this beating case too had he not been evicted, you know, 3 months prior to this whole thing taking place, because he knew the boys involved. He knew Charlie Young Jr. I'm referring to David Crowley. And one thing that he said saved him was the fact that he got involved in a program called Urban Underground, run by Charlene and Reggie Moore. Reggie Moore, he's also ran the Office of Violence Prevention here in Milwaukee. And one thing that they taught the young people how to do is see value in themselves, see value in others. And one thing David Crowley said, it was the first program to teach him how to love and how to love another person. Other things that help, first jobs. You know, David Crowley was able to find a job at the age of 14, cutting grass, working for this lawn service. And his employer was this black man who hired a lot of young people to work and teach them the value of work and how important it is to come to work every day, be on time, and have some level of responsibility. You know, 75 to 80% of our young people today living in very troubled areas can't find work. And so those things really help. But honestly, mentorship is one of the strongest factors that come into play here. You know, and you don't have to have like a medical background. But if you could just talk to a youth who may not, whose father may not be around, or it may have been in an abusive situation, sometimes just talking to a young person and getting them to express how they feel, that goes a long ways too.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Donna is with us in Wauwatosa. Donna, hi.
Hi. I absolutely agree that there has to be a lot of intervention with these families that have a lot of trauma. And I'm not even sure where to begin, but I did want to say this. You said that the educational system failed him because he couldn't read. I spent years working in MPS, And in order to teach kids, they have to show up. And a lot of times these kids didn't show up, or they moved from school to school to school. And, you know, as teachers, we want to teach kids to read. We want to help them, but they have to show up too. I'm just wondering if this young man, you know, wasn't skipping out all the time, if he actually showed up.
Donna, thanks for the call. James, the difficulties a kid like Marlon faced in the school system, can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I could talk a little bit about that. So one thing that I think happened with Marlon, he wasn't a kid who got into a lot of trouble in school, but I think he was a kid who he did have his struggles in, you know, he read at a second grade level. It was no way in hell he should have been in eighth grade. I mean, he kept getting passed, and that doesn't do anybody any good if you keep passing a kid who can't read, because if this pattern would have continued, imagine him passing 12th grade, reading on the third or fourth grade level. What good does that do for him or society? He can only turn to a couple of things, you know, crime and maybe the illegal drug trade, because if you can't read, that's one of the basic foundations for a lot of things. So I'm not just blaming teachers, but there's something, he fell through the cracks, and someone has to take responsibility for that. Because, I mean, one thing that he told me that was very telling, when he was incarcerated, he tried to write his daughter's mom to tell her, you know, that he cared for her and cared for his daughter, but he couldn't even spell Fond du Lac. So he couldn't even spell the street that she lived on, so he couldn't even write her letters. That's pretty bad.
Donna, thanks for that call. We're talking to James Causey, projects reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab, talking with James about his new series, exploring connections between trauma, youth, and the criminal justice system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. For youth who end up in the criminal justice system, do you think there needs to be more attention to these kind of traumas that may have led a kid there in the first place? Have you encountered this system yourself, maybe as a youth or maybe as someone in the criminal justice system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with James Causey, projects reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking with James about his recent series called Life Correction, with a closer look at the role childhood trauma can play in juvenile sentencing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. James, I want to get back to the story of Marlon Dixon, arrested as a teenager. He spent 18 years in prison. You and fellow reporter Angela Peterson were there the day Marlon was released. Angela captured some of his reflections on that day. Here's a clip from the video that you posted on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel website.
I'm going to go on and live my life in a way that now I know what it's like to be a part of something like that, to be inside something like that. Now I know what I must do, you know, to make sure that other people never, you know, join in that type of mentality or join into that type of group and to do something like that.
James, you talked earlier, the initial contact you had was about resources for someone like Marlon, hoping to start a new life after prison. And as we heard there, hoping to prevent people from doing the same things he had done. What resources are out there?
Yeah, so one thing that I pointed out in my series is that the main resource that people need who are coming out of prison is housing, you know, because a lot of people think, well, they could go back to where they were, you know, but, you know, in the case of Marlon, in the case of a lot of people who've been locked up for decades, people have died, people have moved on, been evicted, and things like that. So going in some cases, you can't go back to the same neighborhood that you were living in because, you know, other circumstances come up. You know, he has like 21 things that he can't do or else he'd be violating his parole. Like he can't be living with someone who has a criminal record. And his two of his brothers have criminal records. So he technically can't be around them. And it's a lot of things that he could do to violate his parole. So he had to be very careful and walk on thin ice. And that's why being on this extended supervision for an additional 22 years after he was released is just, it almost sets up people for failure because there's so many things that could be in violation of what he can't do. And one thing that I want to stress too is like I gave Marlon an ACE test. It's a test that determines your childhood trauma when he was incarcerated. It's like 10 questions that really ask basic questions like, have you ever seen your mother abused? Have you been abused? Have you been sexually abused? And it asks a series of 10 questions like that. And he scored an 8 out of 10, which is very high because typically you want to score a 3 or less. And this determines, some people say it could determine how your future ends up, although, you know, it's debatable. But when you have more traumas like that that happened to you as a child, it's not really a good thing. So, you know, what I really wanted to do is stress that, you know, in order for people to who come out of prison, they have to be put on the right path. And housing was what was a tough issue for him because he went back to live with his mother. He couldn't really stay there. And fortunately for him, he met a young lady, and she's like the best thing that happened to him. And they live in Menominee Falls now. Out of a lot of the traumas and a lot of that, the constant sirens and shootings and things like that that he would hear if he was staying where his mother stays.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Madison. Scott, hi.
Hey, hi. Thank you for having this program. So I'm a teacher in the Madison School District, and I heard kind of what was said before about, you know, that he slid through the cracks and he's at a second grade level. And we, as teachers, have this happen all the time where we need, like, more support. We see kids all the time with trauma and with that are behind grade level, and there's not enough support. So even, like, right now I've got kids below grade level that – I can't meet their needs right now, even though I work on different things with them and I'll try to get special supports. We don't have like the manpower, the people power just in the building because there's so much more need now. And if we really want to stop this sort of thing from happening, this is where it should be. It should be like in the schools, like more supports for kids with trauma, with kids that are below grade level, because yeah, we're not serving them well if we just keep passing them on. And it's not that the teachers don't know. We want them to get services. We just don't have the ability to give it to them.
Scott, thanks for the call. James.
I feel your pain on that. And I feel the pain of a lot of teachers. And I've heard this as a constant, you know, after this series ran, where teachers felt like they're being blamed in some way for the Marlon Dixons of the world. And that was not the intent of this. I do agree that teachers, you know, bottom line is, teachers, everybody knows, everybody has had a good teacher, everybody has had a bad teacher, right? I know the great teachers I have made and formed me who I am today. And I've had some teachers that were just kind of just there. But I know a lot of teachers are very passionate about their kids. They're passionate about what they do, and they love their kids. Unfortunately, they can't do it all. And that's where I think these schools need to become educational centers, where not only are they educated the students, but they need to educate families. You know, Marlon's mother was overwhelmed. His father was a high school dropout. So, you know, maybe we need to look at education in a different way. And all this stimulus money that came in, I want to see these educational institutions, these schools, do something with this funding to address and help teachers do the most that they can, because teachers can't do it alone. I've been in schools where I've seen, you know, 30 kids in a classroom and a teacher not even having a paralegal trying to do it by themselves. That's impossible. Even with some of the best students, it's almost impossible. So teachers do need the support, and we got to figure out a way to give them that support.
Thanks a lot for that call, Scott, at 800-642-1234. Talking to James Causey from the Journal Sentinel about his new piece on youth trauma and the criminal justice system. Time for one more caller. Heidi is with us in Dunn County. Hi, Heidi, hello.
Hi, thank you so much for this topic. I am a trauma specialist, and even for me to call in being in private practice, it's actually difficult for me because there's so many community members who frown upon youth who have been incarcerated, who are coming out of incarceration, whether coming out of day treatments and service centers. And I believe that especially our court system, probation officers, a lot of mental health services, a lot of our schools, they don't know what to do and how to help treat these youth. And they believe that these are bad kids and I don't necessarily want them around me when they get out, rather than stepping out and saying, hey, let's give this person a try. What services can we do to advocate? And I just wonder if maybe you have any further resources on what we can do to...
Heidi, I'm going to jump in because we're just about out of time. James, just in our last minute, you looked at what Milwaukee County is doing. Briefly, are some of those attitudes changing that Heidi is worried about?
Yeah, the attitudes are changing, but they're not changing fast enough. And that needs to improve. I mean, there's programs out there, but, you know, a lot of these programs suffered greatly during the COVID pandemic, you know, where they were there before the pandemic happened, where they could have helped people. But Marlon was released during the pandemic, right in the heart of the pandemic. And so a lot of the programs that could have been there to assist him were shuttered, and they couldn't provide any services for him. So what we need to do is, like, now that we're coming out of this pandemic, those programs need to be beefed up and backed financially so that they can help more people. But it's still not enough, even if we fully fund most of these programs that are trying to do the work. So we need to make a complete change in order to help the Marlon Dixons of the world. Or else, if we don't help him, guess what? We're just going to keep this cycle going. He's going to end up back in the system, and we're just going to keep this cycle going. And I don't think anybody wants that.
James, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
James Causey writes from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab. We talked with him about a series called Life Corrections, looking at childhood trauma and criminal sentencing. You can find a link to that series on our website at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up after the news, we help you get ready for Mother's Day on today's edition of Food Friday with brunch recipes and tips for treating mom. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, a Wisconsin political scientist talks about the effects that this week's news about abortion and the U.S. Supreme Court could have on Wisconsin's primary election in August and the general midterm in November. Now, Mother's Day is on Sunday. If you're scrambling to plan a special meal for mom, don't worry. We've got you covered. It's Food Friday. Today, it's all about the moms. A lot of us might have fond memories of growing up cooking with our mothers or that one recipe that no one else could make quite right. Mother's Day is the day we can show our appreciation with a good, maybe Sunday brunch. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you and your family celebrate Mother's Day with food? What makes a great Mother's Day meal? Does it have to be brunch? If you're a mom, what's your favorite food or recipe to have someone maybe make for you on Mother's Day? And hey, I'm trying to figure out what to make for my wife and mother-in-law on Sunday, and they're a tough crowd. No, I'm just kidding. They're very easygoing. But I do need ideas. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Katie Workman is a food writer for the Associated Press and contributor to Food 52 and TheKitchen.com. She's the author of the cookbooks Dinner Solved and The Mom 100 Cookbook. Her website is themom100.com. She's a mom herself. Katie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
Okay, let's start with that question. You know, when we think Mother's Day, I think we think Mother's Day brunch. Do you have a preference for brunch being the meal of Mother's Day?
You know, it's funny. I do think that often people sort of default to the brunch thought, but dinners also, lunches and dinners are also very popular. And I think, you know, much of it might depend on which time of the day you and your mom can get together. And, you know, then you also have the idea that there might be possibly more than one celebration because, you know, if you are a mother, you might hope that your children might do something for you. And if you are lucky enough to still have your mother, you might also want to do something for her. So I don't know that we should limit it to one meal. We've got 24 hours.
All right. Now, say we're in a routine where we do the same type of meal every year for Mother's Day. How can we mix it up this year if we want to?
Well, I think that often it's kind of fun to sort of take this moment to explore a different cuisine, and maybe it's someplace that your mom's always wanted to go, or maybe someplace that you've traveled with your mom and you want to sort of recreate those, some favorite dishes or some favorite flavors. That's a nice way to sort of go about it. For me, my mom actually became vegetarian several years ago. So for the meal part that I will be making for her, I will be, you know, creating a mostly vegetarian meal and also some meatier aspects for the other people in our gang.
Now, mom isn't always the main cook in a house. Like, I'm kind of the lead cook in our household. But for the situation, maybe somebody's listening saying, okay, yeah, she usually makes the dinners and brunches and whatnot. I want to give it a go. What are some simple things for that person who might not be the head chef in their own household?
Well, it's getting towards grilling season, depending on where you live in the country.
Oh, we're in Wisconsin. It's always grilling season.
So, and there's definitely hardcore grillers. I mean, if you are not, you know, the most adept cook, you can certainly pick up, you know, marinate some chicken or pick up a really good steak. Or if your mom's vegetarian, you can just get some beautiful vegetables and throw those on the grill. You really don't need anything more than a set of tongs, some salt, some olive oil, maybe some lemon juice. And you can, you know, just kind of look up cooking times and eyeball it. And, you know, just that's really simple. I also am a huge fan of grain salads. I think that, you know, just cooking up grains, which for the most part is no more difficult than cooking up a pot of rice or making pasta, and then using those grains and adding in vegetables, maybe dried fruit, making a nice vinaigrette. And I love to mix a lot of, sometimes I mix grains into, you know, green salads as well to give it a little bit more heft and more interest. So one of the dishes that I know I'm going to make some variation of this weekend is a kale and quinoa salad with dried cherries. And for that, all you have to do is you cook up your quinoa, which is 15 minutes, basically start to finish. And then you just do like kind of a pulsed mixture of parsley and mint and kale and scallions and, you know, some lemon juice and olive oil. And you just toss that together and throw in a few handfuls of dried cherries or cranberries. That's like, if you want, you know, to add that little punch of sweet, tart, dried fruit. But it's such a flexible thought. You know, it's really, you can substitute any grains in. You can mix and match the herbs and the vegetables. You can just, you know, really play around with things that you might already have on hand.
It's Food Friday. And hey, good news. Our guest shared that recipe for kale and quinoa salad with dried cherries. We've got it up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Katie Workman is with us. She's written the cookbooks Dinner Solved and the Mom 100 Cookbook. Our theme today is getting ready for Mother's Day on Sunday. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about what to make on Sunday or how to make it, or if you want to share your menu for Mother's Day with us, love to hear it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Katie, you shared another recipe with us. And I got to say, this one, it is on my maybe list for Sunday. A lazy oven French toast casserole. Like, I like making bread puddings. And this is kind of in the ballpark of a bread pudding almost. Tell us about this lazy oven French toast casserole.
Yes. I mean, I always sort of roll my eyes at my own recipe name because, of course, it's not your oven that's lazy. It's kind of maybe us. But, you know, the whole point of this casserole is, you know, everybody loves French toast and it's such a perfect Mother's Day brunch dish. But making individual slices of French toast for everybody can be time consuming and kind of, you know, take away from being at the table together. So this is basically like a strata or a bread pudding, as you said. And it's layers of challah, or you could use brioche. I love an egg-based bread in a French toast situation. It's just, it provides so much flavor. And you just slice it up, let it dry out a bit, and then you layer it with, you know, your basic mixture of sort of milk and eggs and a little bit of sugar, maple syrup, some cinnamon, touch of vanilla, and you layer it up again. You can throw some dried fruit or nuts into it if you want. And you just layer, you soak the bread in the custard mixture and cover it and throw it in the fridge overnight. And then the next morning you pull it out and you preheat the oven and you put it in the oven. And while you're doing that, you can put out some bowls of berries or, you know, some maple syrup, some softened butter, and, you know, pour some fresh squeezed orange juice. And when the casserole comes out, everybody can sit down and eat at the same time.
And let's talk about the premeditated angle of this, because when I do make my bread pudding types of things, I just mix them up and throw them in the oven. What am I going to get if I let it sit overnight?
It's just the bread is going to soak up everything.
Nice.
It's, you know, you don't have to let it sit overnight. You could let it sit for an hour or two. But, the point being, of course, if you want to get up in the morning and just have it ready to go in the oven and not have to start, you know, mixing and blending and fussing in the morning, you'll have it all done. But a couple hours will do it, and it just gives that bread, you know, it just saturates the bread. So you have that incredible, I mean, the top gets this beautiful kind of puffy crust, but the middle is like just creamy and completely delicious.
That sounds great. Now, I think a lot of people talk about the influence of cooking with a parent, a mom, and what they've learned from them and maybe passing to the next generation. We talk about that sometimes on Food Friday. Do you have things like that, that you're like, yeah, I got this from my mom, and or passing it on to your own kids?
Yeah, my mom was a really good cook. She was a very intuitive cook, and she was a pretty adventurous cook too. And she had some dishes that she had, like, project dishes that she would make for company. She made, when company, I remember, like, on special occasions, she would make a paella, which was, like, back in those days, it was really rare to come to somebody's home and have a paella served to you, and it probably still is. I can't think of that many paellas that have been served in somebody's home. And so she would, you know, really, you know, she'd have the saffron and the right rice and the seafood and you know, just really sort of layer it up. But even now, she starts with a recipe and kind of just starts throwing things together. And she's just got a really good feel for ingredients and sort of experimentation. And I feel like that rubbed off on my sister and myself, too.
Now, I got to say, having had little kids once upon a time, they're, you know, in college now. But adventurous was not always the word they were looking for in my cooking.
No.
Predictable and routine, I think.
Yes.
Did you find ways to get kids to appreciate those adventures and experiments?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just so much of it has to do with exposure, just having kids feel familiar with you know, different flavors, whether they're being trying them at a restaurant or you're experimenting a little more at home. And it's just it's repeated exposure. And the sort of like getting comfortable and not sort of sticking to your rut, which of course puts your kids in a rut, but you know, and being patient. I mean, there's a lot of ways to go about this. There's the, you know, take one bite rule. There's the, you know, and you figure out what works for your family. But I mean, I'm not a proponent of you're going to eat everything on your plate or you're not leaving the table. I'm not the biggest fan of that. I think that tends to backfire, but just, you know, this, I'm not putting so much pressure on things. And I always think of this one dinner where my kids were really little and they were sitting at a table and there was a bunch of teenagers in our group and they were all just happily eating. I remember it was a curried squash, butternut squash, I think, soup or a pumpkin soup.
Ooh.
And my kids just sat there and they just like ate the soup along with these kids because they just like weren't going to, they didn't want to, they did want to look like the picky little kids at the big kid table. So if you can just sort of like, again, keep exposing them and sort of make food feel like something that's sort of joyful and, you know, fun to try and just keep at it and try not to like engage in the control thing. You know, it's really hard as a parent. I'm the first to say, but the more pressure you put on your kids to eat certain things or be adventurous, you know, it tends to become a rebellious moment because little kids especially don't have all that much control in their life. One thing they really can control is what they put on their fork and put in their mouth. So, you know, if you don't engage in sort of the power struggle, it often becomes less of a power struggle.
We're talking to food writer and cookbook author Katie Workman about Mother's Day meals for this week's edition of Food Friday. Katie's the author of Dinner Solved and the Mom 100 Cookbook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. On a practical level, do you need advice for your upcoming Mother's Day meal, or do you want to share your plans, maybe your tradition? Is there something that happens every year on Mother's Day? And what influence did maybe your own mom have on your cooking? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Katie Workman, author of the cookbooks Dinner Solved and the Mom 100 Cookbook. She's a food writer also for the Associated Press. She's with us today on Food Friday to help us cook a great meal for Mother's Day. Katie gave us a couple recipes, a kale and quinoa salad, and this awesome-sounding oven-baked French toast arrangement. Find those at WPR.org/Food Friday, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a mom, what is the best Mother's Day meal that's ever been served to you, whether it was a big fancy production or maybe a bowl of cereal lovingly prepared by a two-year-old? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know your traditions, what's on your menu for Sunday, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Adrian on Facebook, who writes, "My mom's been gone for nearly 50 years, but she taught me most of what I know, from how to make bread to turning me loose with a cookbook to cook for 40 people. Still love the old favorites like cinnamon rolls. No written recipe. It was a given that you could make these. But like to explore recipes from all over. A great gift from my mom." And Katie, that no written recipe reminds me, I've definitely had family members where they might try to teach you to cook something. Mm-hmm. It might not be written down somewhere. Have you found good ways to convey those kind of traditional family recipes that were just winging it in some cases?
I know, and I will say in general, the best sort of cooks, the moms and the grandmothers, and this is true, like Jewish, Italian, Mexican, like every, you know, the best cooks often don't have a recipe and they eyeball everything and they don't even have measurements to share. So I've had many friends be like, you know, and I was trying to watch my Nona and she did, you know, she was throwing in a handful and I was like, wait, how much Parmesan is that? And there's rarely an answer. It's like, you know, it's just, so I think, you know, if you are lucky enough to have one of these cooking teachers in your life, then, you know, taking the time to sort of show up in the kitchen, bring a pad and a pen and or your computer and just say, you know, I'd love to try to like slow it down and capture this so that I can, you know, have this recipe forever. And I, you know, by and large, most people are pretty flattered and excited to think that their recipes are going to live on and, you know, prosper after they're gone. So it's really a worthy thing to do. And I have a ginger snap recipe that was my great grandmother's, and I'm sure it really wasn't hers. I don't think she created it, but you know, it's really nice to think that your ginger snaps are, you know, if not the same, based similar to the ones that your great, it was my great grandmother actually. So, you know, these, you know, there's still a lot of people also have these wonderful collections of recipe cards or things that they've ripped out of newspapers over the years. And I love it when I sometimes buy an old cookbook, like at a thrift store or flea market, and then inside the cookbook, there's some handwritten recipes tucked in between the pages. Mm. And you just, there's just something so personal about it. And you just can sort of like vaguely imagine somebody clipping something in 1970 and, you know, tucking it into their Betty Crocker book or whatever.
Adrian, thanks for sharing that story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's Food Friday, talking to Katie Workman, author of Dinner Solved and the Mom 100 Cookbook, getting ideas for Mother's Day. Still time for your comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday, and still time for you to call in, if you like, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Katie, I know a lot of times there will be a tradition of bringing the kids, maybe littler kids, in to help with a Mom's Day meal. What are some good things that kids can really, you know, feel a sense of accomplishment helping out in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. Both cookbooks, both in the Mom 100 and Dinner Solved, in for each recipe, I give advice on what the kids can help do, because I do agree that it is super important to bring them into the kitchen. The earlier, the better. And even if they're not really that helpful at the beginning, it's you know, you're sort of paying it forward so that when they get older, they'll have that confidence and hopefully just also an appreciation for food. And kids are very much more likely to try something if they've had a hand in making it. So that's another reason to get the kids there. And, you know, just thinking about age-appropriate tasks, you know, like obviously bigger kids who are more adept in the kitchen can do a lot, but little kids, they can, you know, say you need some fresh herbs, you can ask them to pull the oregano leaves off the stem or crack an egg or measure flour or whisk something. You know, be careful about heat and knives, of course, and supervise, you know, unless you are 100% positive that your kid is capable of doing a particular task, don't, you know, take your eyes off them. But really, we all know the mother, in my case, you know, me, I don't care what they make. That's the truth. I really don't care. I just, you know, especially when they're little, it's just like, it's so just delightful to have your kids sort of do something like that for you. And hopefully also with the help of maybe your partner, remember to clean up, because nothing takes away from the joy of a Mother's Day meal like a sink full of dirty dishes. I can tell you that right now. But, you know, it really truly is kind of the thought that counts. And, you know, yes, you want to try to pick something that you know your mom's going to like. And, yes, you want to put a little bit of attention in it, you know, try to make the meal visually appealing as well as tasty. But I don't think there's been a mom who has had a Mother's Day meal prepared for her with the help of her children who's ever been like, well, that stunk.
Funny. Let's bring on a caller now. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. This is kind of a bittersweet story, but when my sister many years ago had ovarian cancer and was fairly sure that she wasn't going to make it through. And so that year when she had a lot of time to sit and think, she was a really good cook and could like look at what was in the refrigerator and make something out of it. But she never wrote any of those things down. So she tried to think of all of the meals that she had made that the kids really liked, that her husband really liked, all of that. And she wrote them all down so that all three of them would have them. And, I mean, her kids were in fifth grade and seventh grade. They were cooking by that time. But, you know, they still have them today, and they're in their late 30s.
Wow. Susie, thank you so much for sharing that. And Katie, that really speaks to the memories we can attach to the food that that our parents, our moms in this case, make.
Yeah, Susie, thank you so much for sharing that. And it is like such a very personal little legacy to leave your kids, and so thoughtful of her to do that. And I'm sure it means so much to them to have these recipes now, and to, you know, especially if, you know, when they were, you know, when she passed, if they were really little, they might sort of have the memories of these dishes, but they might be sort of fuzzier. So to have this written down so that they can sort of recreate some of it is just beautiful.
Susie, thanks so much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Katie, in just our last few moments, do you know what's on menus, whether the part you're making or the part that's being made for you on Sunday?
Well, I am hoping that breakfast is not my problem and that my kids and my husband show up in some way for that. And then in the afternoon, actually, I'm speaking to Susie's sort of bittersweetness. I just lately have had a number of family members and friends lose their mothers in the past recent weeks, even, and months. And so we're actually, it's very nice. We're getting together with some very good family friends, one of whom has just lost his mom. And he called me and he said, can we have Mother's Day with you and your mom this year? And we do a lot together, so it wasn't sort of out of the blue. But I said, absolutely. So, you know, so we're sharing my mom this year.
That's lovely. Katie, thanks so much for joining us. That's Katie Workman, food writer, author of the cookbooks Dinner Solved and the Mom 100 Cookbook. She joined us for Food Friday for Mother's Day. Find a couple of her recipes online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Competition can inspire amazing acts of human achievement, and the Guinness Book of World Records marks some of the weirdest of those achievements. In one of their categories, there's been an escalating record, with the latest one set just last month in the category of stacking M&M candies. As reported by Yahoo News, I found this via Metafilter, the record for the most M&Ms successfully stacked on top of one another was set last month by a 29-year-old in Iraq. The new record, 7. M&Ms. Turns out it's really hard to stack a single width tower of M&Ms. The original mark was set in 2016 at 4. It's been broken 3 times since then. The current record holder used special gloves and a steady hand to hit the 7 mark. Also, the same guy holds the record for the most balanced eggs on the back of the hand. 18 of them. And that one could get a lot messier. Keep reaching for the stars. This is Central Time.